Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Joyce R. from Midtown Group in Washington, D.C.
Hi, my name is Joyce, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 24th, 2005. I have a sponsor, a home group, and the privilege of sponsoring other women. And thank you, Dave and Sarah, for asking me to come up and share my experience. I've heard wonderful things about this group throughout my sobriety, and I've been up here a couple years ago, and I don't know. You know, I think the most important thing is that when I'm asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it's a privilege. And if you're new, that may sound really lame, you know, but this program, I mean, has saved my life. You know, for a girl like me, Alcoholics Anonymous was the last stop. You know, I mean, this is the only thing that prevented me from drinking myself to death. And for that, you know, I owe my life to it. And I hope I spend the rest of my life, you know, paying it back. So I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and how I try to live today. And my story starts in Jersey. I was born and raised in Jersey City, New Jersey, and I came from a family of drunks, you know, and that's not what makes me alcoholic. But the reason why I like mentioning it is because I grew up around alcohol, you know, and I had a lot of examples really early on why I should have never picked up that first drink. You know, I mean, my earliest memories were being herded into rooms and the door locked behind us and hearing chaos and madness and fighting and getting in cars with drunk drivers. And really, you know, I remember swearing to myself, I'm never going to be like these people. You know, I'm never going to be like my father. You know, I hate what that stuff does. I hated alcohol and what it did to people. But, you know, if you're an alcoholic of my type, you know, my problem started way before I even picked up my first drink, you know. And I didn't understand that until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and heard people talk about it as a spiritual malady. You know, I mean, before I ever picked up that drink, there was something wrong with me on my insides. You know, I couldn't connect to people. I was, you know, riddled with fear and anxiety and discomfort and disconnected. I mean, and I didn't know what that was. You know, and I'm sure there are a lot of people out there in the world that suffer with some sort of spiritual malady. But the thing is that for an alcoholic like me, I mean, when I had my first drunk the summer of fifth grade, it fixed that. You know, I was 10 years old and I was thirsty. And I don't know what a 10-year-old has to be stressed out about, but I was stressed, you know, and I was uncomfortable, and I was dying for a solution. And alcohol, I mean, really, I mean, there's a speaker out in California, Johnny Harris, who talks about it, I mean, preserved my life, preserved my sanity. And that's what happened, is that day, and I remember it like it was yesterday, you know, I had been stalking this boy. His name was Jason. I mean, it was my first obsession, you know, and I know women in here know what I'm talking about. And, I mean, I'm talking about carved his name in my arm. I still today memorize his phone number. I'm talking of deep obsession, you know. I loved him. And he was like some punk, you know, couple years older than me. He drank and dealt some dime bags of weed and stuff like that. And I wanted to impress him, you know, so I told him that my family drank a lot and we had a bar. You know, we had a fully beautiful stock bar and a walk-in liquor closet. And I told him that if he wanted to get drunk, he could come over. My family was always partying, you know, on the weekends, and they were gone. And he took me up on it. And here I was, you know. I'll never forget it. I mean, he came over. He brought the track star and this really popular girl over. And up to this point, I'm a loser. You know, I'm a nerd. I'm a stuttering allergy baby loser with, like, you know, with my inhalers and, you know, and with my Kmart clothes because we didn't have much. And, I mean, I was so out of place. And here I was. I had social intentions for my first drunk. You know, I was going to win these people over and I was going to become cool and hang out and you know, make them fall in love with me. And he came over and, you know, I experienced all that self-centeredness that if you're an alcoholic like me, you know, you experience, right? That loud, hostile mind. You know, telling you you're a loser, telling you that nobody likes you, you know, telling you what to say, not to say, laugh, you know, that's reading people's minds around you, what they're thinking about you. You can hear all their thoughts, you know, and I was like shaking and stuttering and sweating. I mean, I was so nervous. And we went downstairs to this bar, and I took a couple glasses out, I put them in front of us, and I poured some Johnny Walker Black Label. you know, and I had taken sips and swigs of liquor and beer, you know, I mean, forever, and it didn't scare me. I was familiar with the taste, and I knew what my family drank, and I knew how they drank, so I poured out a couple shots, and we drank that stuff down, and this is what makes me alcoholic. You know, what happened in the next 5 minutes of me drinking a glass of Johnny Walker Black Label is what possessed me for the next 8 years. You know, because I got that effect produced by alcohol, that effect that only happens to an alcoholic like me. You know, it didn't just make me feel good. It changed me. You know, it saved me. And I drank that stuff down. It hit my stomach. It rose to my head. And I became a different person. The people around me became different people. It changed my and altered my reality. You know, and I started drinking that stuff, and all of a sudden, I'm standing up taller, I'm smarter, I'm funnier, and I look across the bar, and I'm like, this kid Jason's a loser, you know, and I kick him out. I kick him and his friends out. It's just me and Johnny Walker the rest of the night, you know, and a three-year obsession, one glass of Johnny Walker, like that, and that really summarizes, you know, what I chased for the next 8 years, you know, is that, and it really summarizes my relationship with alcohol. It was so powerful, so potent, that it really trumped everyone and everything around me, you know. And I, no one had to teach me how to drink every day. No one had to teach me how to take the morning drink or the nightcap at night. I mean, it was as natural as blinking and breathing to me, you know, because from that point forward, it was like Bill Wilson describes, I had arrived. You know, I found the solution for living, and I finally got it, and the lights came on, and everything made sense. And you could look at photographs of me from before I started drinking and after I started drinking, and I became a different person. And so that's what happened. You know, I began drinking as often and as much as possible, and we had such an abundance of liquor that it wasn't even difficult. You know, I mean, at first I tried to be slick and would fill up water bottles of liquor at a time and start sneaking it around. And then I was like, what am I doing? No one even noticed it. So I just started taking handles at a time, you know. And my whole persona changed. I became life of the party. You know, we were, you know, I brought liquor with me everywhere. Bus stop at the school in the morning, you know, 7-Eleven. You know, if we were doing anything, I was bringing alcohol because it just made everything a better time, you know. And I loved it. You know, my first couple years of drinking was absolutely a great time. You know, I'm not here to badmouth alcohol. It changed, it saved me. You know, and I had, you know, we'd have hysterical stories and be traveling up to New York City and, you know, waking up in the woods. And it was just, you know, it seemed like harmless fun, and I felt untouchable. You know, it was like no matter how much I drank, I would always make it home. I would always be, it would be consequence-free, and it would just be a great story on Monday morning, you know, that we'd be laughing about. And I got this reputation for being a hard drinker, for being a party girl, and I love that even more, you know. But, you know, unfortunately, if you're an alcoholic, like I'm an alcoholic, I have this progressive illness. And I don't know when, how, where, or why, but eventually I crossed the line. You know, I crossed that line between the hard drinker and the alcoholic. And something happened where I began to lose control. You know, and I began to experience this phenomenon of craving, you know, this allergy to alcohol that, you know, at first was undetectable because every time I drank, I wanted to drink as much as possible. So it wasn't really anything unusual, you know, but suddenly, all of a sudden, you know, after my first intervention, I had my first intervention within 2 years, chairs circled up, people crying at me, yelling at me. They sent me to substance abuse counseling. I'm baffled and confused because I'm just having a good time. You know, but to everyone else, there's clearly something wrong with me because I drink too much. You know, so from that point forward, you know, there was like the red flag in my mind. You know, I told everybody I didn't have a problem. Oh, it's because my family's crazy or this and that. I have things to point to and tell them why I drink the way I do or why I'm living the way I am. But deep down inside, you know, I had no idea. And from that point forward, you know, began the madness of trying to enjoy and control my drinking. And that's when, you know, looking in hindsight, looking at my story, I could see that phenomenon of craving really take hold of me. Because I would go out, and I would not have any intention of getting drunk. You know, I just wanted to have, you know, two drinks, three drinks. You know, I wanted to be social. I wanted to remember what happened. And all of a sudden, I'd be falling down, you know, blacking out drunk. And I began experiencing these consequences, you know, my first blackout, coming to, waking up naked, bruised, bloody, you know, not knowing who I was with, what had happened, feeling, you know, that incomprehensible demoralization the book talks about. And I, you know, would wake up with that, with those four hideous horsemen, you know, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, and I'd be in that madness. How did I get here? What happened last night? Why couldn't I just have a couple, you know? And that would take hold of me, and I would be, you know, scared straight. You know, I'd be scared straight for maybe 2 hours, maybe 5 hours, maybe 3 days. But eventually, you know, the second part of this illness that we have is this insanity of the mind. You know, because after, whether it be a couple hours, a couple days, something would happen and my mind would start to turn on me. And it starts to rationalize what happened that night. You know, oh, you didn't eat enough. Oh, someone must have roofied you. Oh, you got to do a little bit more drugs on the side to balance it out. You know, oh, it's just those people. You know, they're bad luck, or, you know, those are troublemakers. You got to find a new group of people. And I'd find, you know, these justifications why it wasn't my fault, why it wasn't the drink's fault. And I'd come up with yet another plan, you know, that this time, this is going to work. And like it talks about in you know, more about alcoholism, and there's a solution. I mean, I tried all those ways. You know, I switched brands. I tried counting. I tried drinking just by myself. I just tried drinking socially. I just tried drinking on the weekend. Just tried drinking on weekdays. I mean, every combination, you know, I just, like, was trying to figure out there's got to be some sort of mathematical equation, you know, that I can get back to that place where I was just feeling good. And you know, that was maddening, you know, and the longer that I drank for, I mean, the more sordid places I ended up going to, you know, and I started picking up harder substances, I started burning bridges, you know, started sacrificing my morals and principles and ending up in places that I never thought I would, you know. I didn't, like, wake up one day and was like, man, I can't wait to wake up at crack houses and in basements. I can't wait to wake up in gravel and not know how I'm going to get home. You know, I never had that intention. You know, I just ended up there. I was just on this train, and I wasn't driving. And, you know, and I had a couple of moments of clarity. You know, my first moment of clarity, you know, I'd gotten suspended from school yet again for getting drunk. You know, I could not. I mean, it was pretty a funny story. It was like a school trip. We went to Jersey, and we went to Baltimore, the Baltimore Aquarium right there in the harbor. And it was 9 a.m., you know, and I just wanted a cocktail with my breakfast. So I just poured a little vodka in my orange juice, and I blacked out. I came to, and I was being chased around an aquarium, which is a very trippy experience, you know what I mean? And I thought it was a funny story, and I laughed about it. My parents had to pick me up, and I got suspended for 5 days. And it was like vacation, you know, we were like dumb kids. And it was like no big deal. But the next morning, you know, I came down the stairs hungover, and my mother was sitting at the kitchen table, and she was distraught, you know. I mean, she hadn't slept. She was just sitting there crying. And in my life, in my world, you know, my mom was the only person who didn't drink, who didn't hit me, who didn't, you know, wasn't abusive in any way. She went to church every Sunday, prayed, you know, did rosaries on Monday. She was like a good Catholic woman. And there she was sitting at the kitchen table, you know, just hysterical. And she walked over to me, and she was like, by this point, I'm used to being screamed at. I'm used to being attacked and, you know, people asking me questions like, what's wrong with you? What were you thinking? You know, and when people come at you like that, I mean, you just shut down. You know, I just shut down, you know, I give them lip service and put on some crocodile tears and make them feel sorry for me. But this time, my mom, she didn't scream. She just came over to me and took me and embraced me. You know, she started crying, and she said, do you need help? You know, do you need help? Just tell me what you need. I will give you whatever you need. Just tell me, what do you, like, do you need help? Is there something wrong? And she was, for that split second, and I don't know if you're like me, I mean, about a few years into my drinking, you know, I became an animal, you know, like, that could just blow through people, you know, no remorse, no regret. You know, people could be looking me in the eyes during these interventions, and, you know, and I could just look right through them. I could be looking right at them and look right through them. And this particular morning, I looked at my mother, and I couldn't look through her, and I saw what I was doing to the person that loved me the most. And I got honest. You know, I started crying and told her that I didn't want to live like this, that there was something wrong with me, that, you know, I told her everything. I couldn't stop drinking, how I drank every day, how I was hooked on all these drugs. And she, you know, we cleaned everything up. They cleaned out my room. They threw out everything that I had. They locked up all the liquor in the house. They rallied people at school. I had a day count. You know, I'd go into school and people would be, day 10, and applaud in the hallway. And you know what I mean? Like, if love and support and care could get me sober, you know, it would have a long time ago. But like, you know, like our literature talks about, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices, you know, because all that love and care and support, I mean, it would keep me sober 1 week, 2 weeks, and at that particular time, 1 month was the longest I ever made it on my own, white knuckling it. And but something happens to me. You know, something happens to me. If I had a drinking problem, I would stop drinking, and then I would be fine, and I could go about my life. You know, my problem is that I stop drinking, and that's when all my problems start. You know, because it's undetectable to a normal person. Because after 2 weeks, they think your life is getting better. You know, your family trusts you again. You know, you're employable again. You know, you look healthier. You're eating again. You know, we know where you are. We don't have to worry about you, and all of that. But if you're an alcoholic, 2 weeks sober, 2 weeks bone dry, it just makes you crazy. You know, that restless, irritable, discontent. And how do you describe that to a normal person? You know, and that was what it was. So, I mean, I thought I had a mental disorder. You know, because people would say, they would see that I was irritable and they'd be like, what's wrong? And I couldn't tell them. I couldn't point at anything and say, this is why I feel this way. But I was thirsty, you know. My insides were so unmanageable. And eventually I would just surrender to the drink. You know, I'd be around alcohol, and one of two things would happen. Either one, I would experience that peculiar mental twist that would rationalize why it was okay to take that drink, or two, I would experience a mental blank spot. I'd get around alcohol, I wouldn't think at all, and that stuff would be in my mouth. You know, and I'll never forget, you know, that after that 30-day period and I came to and I had a drink in my mouth, I was like, what am I doing? And then what's the point anyway? You know, and I would continue on another binge. And what made that binge different from the dozens of other times that I tried to stop drinking was that my mother had a brain aneurysm 2 months into that binge. And she had a brain aneurysm on Christmas Eve. She collapsed, and she was taken to JFK Hospital in Jersey. And, you know, we rushed in the hospital. And I remember going in that chapel and feeling disgusted with myself, you know, getting the news that she was going to never recover, and that was it. And I remember feeling that, you know, there's no more sweet promises. There are no more second chances, you know, that she never got the daughter that she deserved, and I hated myself. And, you know, like the book talks about, you know, taking a solemn oath, and that's what I did. You know, no one was around me. I wasn't promising anyone anything. I took a solemn oath on my own that, you know, for the sake of her memory, I'm never going to drink again. You know, I'm gonna honor her memory, and I'm gonna honor the woman that she was, and I'm gonna be different. And 1 week goes by, 2 weeks goes by, and I'm drunk again. So now it's just me and my drunken father, and we're drinking round the clock now. You know, it's a no holds bar. We don't have to hold anything together for anyone, and we're drinking round the clock, and it's insanity. You know, there are some. You know, just to give you, a description of what type of daughter I was, because I don't want to ever portray that I was a victim. You know, that, you know, my dad, after my mother died suddenly, he was, you know, depressed and had all sorts of mental problems and was prescribed these medications, and I would steal those medications so I could reinforce my drinking with them and leave him shaking and crying and looking for him. You know, the type of daughter I was is that my father would be carried home drunk by his, you know, drunken friends, and they'd say, you have to take care of him, you have to watch him, he's really sick. And I'd say yes, and I'd bring him up and I'd leave him on his back so he could choke on his vomit. You know, that's the type of human being that I became. You know, total disregard for anybody around me. And you know, and after 4 years of living that in that madness, the only thing that I became convinced of was that he was my problem. You know, my emotional baggage was my problem. My reputation in New Jersey was my problem. That I just need to start over somewhere else. I need a fresh new start, you know, and I can do this. And I left New Jersey, and by the end of that 4 years, I burned every bridge. There was no one left. That party girl, that life of the party was long gone, you know. I mean, I would try to go to a party, they would literally shut it down and move it somewhere else where I wasn't, because I'd become such a liability. You know, nobody wants to party with you when you're, like, running into traffic, assaulting people at the party, you know, trying to run people over when they're trying to take your keys away from you because you can't drive. I mean, I just was a mess. And I left there and I went down to D.C. in an attempt to recreate my life. And I got down there, and the same night that I landed into D.C., I was coming to on some dirty bathroom floor, you know, people I didn't know doing the same things that I was doing in Jersey. And I was baffled, you know. And I, you know, it was like you had just relocated my whole life. Nothing had changed. I found all the same people, and I started doing all the same things, and it was the same game over and over again, except, you know, I found worse sorted more places. And, you know, I had no intentions of getting sober, no intentions of asking for help. You know, towards the end of my drinking, towards that last year of my drinking, I wasn't trying to be a party girl. I wasn't trying to be a socialite. You know, I entered that realm of desperation drinking. You know, where I was just trying to get my fix, you know, subside the pain that I was living in, you know, try to put me in oblivion so I didn't have to be conscious of the chaos that I was living in. And that was it, you know. And by the grace of God, you know, my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous was in 2004. You know, I by this point, it was just me and my junkie friends, and I was drinking with my dealer. And by this point, they would try to find places where I couldn't get out in public. You know, they'd find out, like, abandoned apartments or, you know, lock me in rooms so I could drink there by myself, you know. They'd give me what we needed, and we'd lock ourselves in there for days or nights at a time. And this one particular night, we got a handle of vodka, and she found an apartment building with a rooftop, you know. And these rooftops, you know, you can go in, access the roof, but you can't go from the roof into the building, right? Once you close that door, you're locked up there. So that's what we did. We went up there, we locked ourselves up on the roof, and we just started taking swigs of this vodka. And I blacked out, you know, which was like a normal occurrence at this point. It didn't even frighten me. I was just so used to being, you know, time traveling. I was like a resourceful little sucker. You know what I mean? I could like wake up in the woods or wake up in a parking lot and always find my way home like a ratchet animal, you know? And so we were like, you know, I blocked out and I came to, and I didn't come to in that rooftop. You know, I came to and I was in an apartment, and I was on a couch fully clothed, and that freaked me out, you know, because I'm not used to waking up like that. You know, I was fully clothed. I was tucked in, and no bruises, no blood, no moisture. I mean, it was like weird to me, you know. I was like, where am I? I thought I'd gotten abducted by like Jehovah Witnesses. I don't even know what, you know what I mean? I was like, because I had a couple occurrences where people, you know, people try to save us all the time. There's like a black aura around us. And so I was like used to that. And I woke up, I like sat up, and this girl walks over to me, and she hands me a glass of water and sits across from me on the couch. And she just starts laughing, you know, laughing at me. And I was like, who is this broad? You know what I mean? Like, you don't know what I'm capable of. I'm crazy. And she was not threatened by me. She wasn't afraid. She was just laughing. And then she didn't ask me any questions, which I'm not used to. When I'm coming to, people are always asking me questions, you know. And I came to, and she just started telling me her story, right? She would just be like, I was drinking one night, you know, out in Alexandria, Virginia, and I woke up naked in front of the White House. And I, like, was like, that's amazing. You know, I relate to that. I, like, time travel and lose clothes at the same time. It's weird, you know. And she talked about, she was, like, 4'9", you know, 22 years old, and she talked about how she would go to the bar and challenge grown men, you know, drinking contests, and how she had a high tolerance for alcohol, and I love that. You know, I love drinking with people like that. And then she started hitting me, you know, with things that I never heard anyone talk about. She started saying things like, you know, the voices in my head won't shut up until I start drinking. Then I can fall asleep at night. And she talked about how her skin didn't fit, you know, until she started drinking, and then she fed in her own skin. How she could feel lonely in a crowded room of people, you know. And she started saying these things, and I didn't realize it. And I realized it only after I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, this woman was 12-stepping me. She was speaking this language of the heart. You know, one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And what, you know, years of therapists and, you know, well-intentioned professionals tried to do for me, here this woman was, you know, she was 2 months sober. And she talked to me for like 10, 15 minutes. And all of a sudden, I'm nodding my head. My walls come down, and for the first time in my whole life, I feel like she gets it. You know, I don't have to explain anything to her. She gets it. And she told me she was 2 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting with her, and I said yes. And, you know, people have been trying to shove me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to Jesus Camp. I've been to Peace Camp, and, you know, I've been beating pillows and drawing pictures and trying to find my inner child. And, you know what I mean? All people have been trying to help me since I could remember. And here it was in 10 minutes, you know, this girl sold me the solution that was going to save my life. And I went to that. I went to him. She picked me up. I went to a meeting. I got a big book. I got a sponsor. I started going to meetings with her every night. But if you're an alcoholic like me, I mean, we don't go down that easily, you know. And my ego rebuilds so rapidly, you know. And that morning, I'm crying. I'm telling her things about me. I'm being vulnerable and honest. And by that evening, I'm at the meeting, and I'm like, these people are losers. You know, I'm not like them. You know, I looked at the steps on the wall, and I laughed. You know, I'm powerless. Are you kidding me? There's nothing powerless about me. God, you know, I almost became a Franciscan nun. You can't tell me about religion. I know about God. You know, my mother was a God-fearing woman. Look where she's at. You know, and I just like, and you know, I just sat in meetings and just related out, and it was so easy. It's the easiest thing to relate out. You know, and by the end of you know, a little bit, I was just like, no, you know, thank you, I appreciate your time, I got this book, I'll read it on my spare time, and I've got this, you know, thanks for the information, if things get bad, I'll come back, and I left, you know, and yet again, you know, my attempt to control and enjoy my drinking, and the end of my drinking, you know, I like to describe it as the darkest days of hell, you know, I'm hooked on all sorts of hard substances, and by the end of my drinking, I was just drinking grain alcohol. You know, I was by myself, locked up in my bathroom floor, you know, praying to God I not out and not wake up. And I just wanted to be put out of my misery. And, you know, a friend of mine describes it so wonderfully. She's like an animal on the side of the road waiting to die. You know, I begged for a mercy killing. And, you know, I mean, I was so hollow on the inside. You know, I couldn't describe to people how broken I felt. And I loved the way Bill Wilson describes, you know, hitting his bottom and how the bitter morass of self-pity surrounding him, how he would curse himself as a weakling when he looked himself in the mirror because he couldn't take his own life. And I did that countless times. You know, by the end of my drinking, I couldn't look anyone in the eye, let alone myself in the mirror, because I was so disgusted with myself for the animal I had become and for the, you know, what a coward I was that I couldn't take my own life. And, you know, and thankfully, you know, the grace of God crept in yet again, and I got another opportunity at sobriety. My last drunk was April 23rd, was when my last drunk, and April 23rd, 2005, my father got remarried. And he had knocked up this woman, and he said that I had to come up. We were going to have a shotgun wedding, and I needed to be there, you know. And my family hadn't seen me, and I was sick, and I was disgusting, and I cleaned myself up. And I went up there, you know, prepping myself for weeks how I was going to – all I needed to do was make it 48 hours. I needed to go up there, I needed to go to the wedding, and I can come back and live my life. But for the 24 hours or 48 hours that I was up there, I needed to be sober. You know, and I ate healthy, I bought new clothes, I cleaned myself up, and, you know, I went up there, and with all intentions of staying sober, and yet again, you know, I get into that reception, and I start feeling that restless, irritable, and discontent, you know, like something standing on my chest, I can't breathe, I'm uncomfortable, people are looking at me, all that self-centeredness is choking me out. And I just wanted one Jack and Coke. That's what I said. Just drink one Jack and Coke. You can breathe and everything will be fine. You know, I got that Jack and Coke, sat back down, drank that. And, you know, you get that, you can breathe again, you know. The mind quiets down. And what happened that night is what happened the first night I drank. It's what happened most nights I drank. I experienced that phenomenon of craving. I got back up. I walked over to that bar. I said, 2 Jack and Cokes. You know, and I sat back down, I drank those 2, and I said, you know, people are going to notice if I'm going back and forth to the bar, so I'm like, give me 4, you know, so now I'm like hoarding drinks, I'm like, forget the Coke, forget the ice, now I'm just drinking just Jack, I'm taking shots at the bar, blackout, pass out, fall down drunk, can't remember my father's wedding, And, you know, there are no pictures of me from that wedding. They destroyed everything. You know, I was humiliating, and, I broke his heart, and I broke my family's heart. I got phone calls the next morning when I came to. I had to be carried home that night. And nowhere near my worst drunk. You know, awful and humiliating for my family, but nowhere near my first drunk. But I don't know why, on April 24, 2005, that morning, something inside of me surrendered. You know, and if you're new tonight, this is the what happened part. You know, this is the part of stories that I love listening to because, you know, from this point forward to this day, I can't take credit for anything in my life. You know, is that on April 24th, I stopped, I took a bus. I got on a bus in New York to take it back to D.C., and it's a 3.5-hour ride. And I got phone call after phone call from my family members, you know, telling me, you know, what a disappointment I was, you know, how what I did last night, you know, that they all knew I had a drinking problem, they knew something was wrong with me, you know, and, they always get me with, you know, your mother would be disgusted with you, which was always like a devastating blow. And for the first time in my whole life, you know, I had no response. I had no lip service. I had no excuse. I just cried, you know, because I knew that they were right. And I didn't drink or use that day. And then April 25th, I woke up shaking, vomiting, you know, sick as a dog and going through withdrawal. And my junkie friend called a cab, and that cab took me to a clubhouse in Southeast D.C., which is not the nicest part of town. And I stayed at that clubhouse for several days, you know, detoxing. And I was so physically sick, I had no idea what had happened, how addicted on everything I was. But it's amazing, you know, within day four, you know, I felt physically better. I wanted to go home. I left there. I went home. And, you know, that peculiar mental twist was starting to creep back in, you know. Maybe I was overreacting. Maybe I just need to drink wine, get off the hard stuff. Ladies drink wine. I'll be a lady, you know. And that night, you know, I came back home, and that evening around 8:30, this girl knocks on my door. You know, she says, "I heard that you were sober last year. I heard you went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm trying to get sober. Will you take me?" And she had no idea that I was 4 days sober again. And I don't know why, but for some reason, I took her. You know, for some reason, I said, "Yeah, I'll take you. I'll show you where our meeting is." And we looked it up, and we made the last 10 minutes of, it's called the Foggy Bottom Group in downtown D.C. And it was a small candlelight meeting. There was about 10 people in that room, and we walked in, and something inside of me, you know, broke down. I walked into that meeting. I didn't hear anything they said. We sat down outside the circle in the dark, and I just felt safe. And I started crying hysterically. And I'm not like a cry. I don't cry in public, you know, at this point in my life. From sobriety, I'm like a notorious scream crier. But, I don't know why, but I just started sobbing. And these two guys, you know, who are in my home group today, came up to us. We were obviously new. And they got on their phones, and they started calling women from our home group. And these women, they started making plans for us. You know, Alexis will pick you up tomorrow. Anne will pick you up on Friday. You know, everyone, and I don't remember anything. I was just hysterical. And women in my group picked me up morning, noon, and night. And they babysat me. They took me to noon meetings. They took me to the night meeting. And in between those meetings, they'd take me on their mundane tasks. You know, like, "We're going to go grocery shopping." I'd be like, "Oh, so fun," you know. I was like, "This is a miserable existence. I can't even believe." But I don't know why, but I just kept going. I kept letting them pick me up. And we had dinner, and they'd take me hostage in the car, and they'd just talk about themselves incessantly, about their sobriety, about steps, about their drinking. And, you know, and they were just trying to help me qualify, and I didn't see that. And I rode the fellowship. You know, my home group at that time was 300 people. And it was a young people's group, and it was busy and active, and there was so many fun things to do. And, I mean, it was all you had to do is just jump in, and you were totally carried. And I rode that fellowship until I got a job offer. I got a job offer in New York City. And I was like, "I'm so grateful that you guys all helped me to get sober. Thank you." And once again, you know, I was packed my book up, and I was going to go do it on my own. And I moved back up to Jersey so I could commute to New York for this job. And I lost my mind. You know, I
I was 2 months sober, and I went to meetings round the clock. That's all I retained was go to meetings. I went to a meeting in the morning, took the bus to New York, went to a noon meeting at the waterfront, took a bus back to New Jersey, went to a meeting in Mattawan, New Jersey, where I was living with my father, which was an awful idea. And I was waking up in compulsion. You know, waking up in compulsion, wanting to kill myself. I mean, I couldn't function. And you know, my whole early sobriety and my whole life, you know, when I was drinking, people always want to reevaluate my drinking. They'd make me tell you how much I drank and how often I drank and what I drank. And I knew I drank a lot. You know, it was never a question. I always understood that, and it resonated nothing in me. You know, but something happened in that first 2 months where I felt untreated alcoholism, and I understood what the word powerless meant. I understood what the word unmanageable meant, because here I was, dead sober, wanting to be sober, and it felt like I could drink at any time. And, you know, I'm lucky at that time in my sobriety, I found my first sponsor, you know, who quickly started getting me into the steps and explained to me that Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't a place that I attended, that this was a way of life, that I needed to go through these steps if I wanted reprieve, that I needed a psychic change, a spiritual experience. And what that meant in layman's terms is that my insides were broken and now they need to be fixed. My thinking, my feeling, my attitudes, my everything about me needed to change, because the same Joyce was going to drink again and again and again, and I was going to live in that cycle and that madness until this change was produced. And for some reason, you know, I became willing, and I quickly got on a four-step, and my sponsor gave me 1 week to complete my four-step, and I drove back down to Maryland to do a fifth-step, and I caught fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got hooked up with this home group in Chatham, New Jersey, and they were like this militant, crazy group, and I owe my sobriety to them. It's not for everyone. You know, when I first got introduced to this old-timer in that group, he handed me a toe tag, and I was like, I'm like, why are you handing me a toe tag? He goes, that's if you don't finish your fourth step. And I was like, oh my, hello, you know, and nice to meet you too. And you know, it's not for everyone, but they babysat me, and they went above and beyond any lens. You know, they picked me up, and I'd say, where are we going to a meeting? There's a great one right down the street. And they say, no, we're going to go to Baltimore for a meeting. And we're in New Jersey. I was like, what? You know, we're going to New Hampshire for a meeting. And they took me to where the message was. They took me to powerful speakers that, to this day, are my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous and that have changed my sobriety, and my teachers, you know, my heroes. And this group got me involved in, you know, H&I commitments. They took me to detoxes and jails and halfway houses and made me tell my story. And I was like 3 months, 4 months, 6 months sober, and I felt like I had nothing to offer. And they didn't care what I thought. They put newcomers in my car, and they made me drive newcomers. You know, they just got me into that principle of being of service, you know, that I was going to give this away and that I had something that a girl with one day didn't have. And the solution was other-centeredness. And for someone who my whole life I've been obsessed with how I feel and what I want and what I'm not getting, it was like a foreign concept. Because I'd be like, I want to, because I'm very dramatic too. I'm like a dramatic newcomer, like always threatening to kill myself. And I'm like, I'm going to kill myself. And like, oh, go set up the meeting downtown. I was like, what? You know, but I'd be putting those chairs down. All of a sudden, I wouldn't want to kill myself, you know. And I'd be at the diner that night, and I'd make it another sober night. And, you know, I lost that job in New York. I couldn't show up for it. And I ended up moving back down to D.C. And, you know, my home group, And it was exactly what I needed. You know, in New Jersey, I got comfortable because it was such a small group, and especially the town that I lived in. I was the only young, sober woman, you know, let alone person. I mean, it was like a woman. And so they called me the 90-day wonder, you know, and I got all this attention and pat on the head, and everyone thought I was so cute. I was sober, and I loved it. You know, I just ate that shit up. I was like, yes! You know, and my ego loved it, you know. It was like all of a sudden I was getting this, my ego was being fed by Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was like this little monster, you know, that newcomer that like caught fire for AA and then would take the meeting hostage because she knew everything. That was me, you know, like, oh, I know about this, let me share about it. And I was like 3 months sober, I didn't know anything. But you know, the old timers, they just smiled and thought it was adorable. And I moved back down in D.C., and it was like the group grew, and it was 350 people now. And you can't feel special in a group of 350 young people, you know, that were busy and active. And, you know, I went through that phase where I resented my sponsor, resented my home group. It was everyone else's fault. And I didn't know how to be one of many. I didn't know how to make it about the group. I didn't know anything about traditions. You know, I just wanted me, my sobriety. I wanted to ride in on my white horse and sober up women, you know, and to be some sort of AA martyr, you know. And the women, the people in my home group, I mean, saved my life. They taught me. They taught me how to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. They taught me how to be one of many. And they, most importantly, taught me how to start showing up for life. I knew how to hide out in clubhouses and run around and pick new girls up out of the tri-state area, 12-step, you know, homeless people out of the park. I could do that, you know, and I couldn't show up to a job. I had totally neglected my family for my first year of sobriety. And you know, I got situated with women in my home group that began to teach me how to be a woman, teach me how to be a daughter, teach me how to be a sister to my new siblings, taught me how to be an employee, how to be a partner in a relationship. And you know, my sponsor to start, you know, what the turning point for me was steps 8 and 9. You know, I went through this period of 6 and 7, just being beat up by my defects, you know, realizing that, I mean, when I read the third step, you know, 60 to 63, and they talked about how selfishness and self-centeredness was the root of our troubles, and that, you know, they, from that point forward in the book, they don't even talk about alcohol. I mean, I could intellectually understand that, yeah, I was selfish and a taker, and I did a 4-step, and I could see that, yeah, I used everyone around me, and I only cared about myself. But, you know, being dead sober and feeling and acting out in sobriety, I mean, that frightened me. You know, being a liar, a cheater, a thief, you know, putting my hands physically on people, you know, in sobriety. I didn't want to live that way. You know, I knew that I was going to drink, and I was still riddled with resentment against my father. I mean, a year sober, I couldn't sit through meetings about families. I couldn't sit through 9-step meetings. I couldn't sit through big book meetings where they would read a family afterward. I'd walk out and have a drinking compulsion. And I tried to outrun, I tried to outbusy that illness in me. And there I was, you know, running around until 2 a.m., hanging out with people in Alcoholics Anonymous at the diner, chain-smoking cigarettes and drinking Red Bulls. And I'd go home and I'd feel insane and I'd feel hollow. And that spiritual malady was on me again. And I'm grateful, you know, my sponsor pushed me through steps 8 and 9, and it was a turning point, you know, because when I did my A step and solely focused on how I had harmed people, you know, I knew that I was the root of all my troubles, that if I continued to live this way, that I wasn't going to stay sober. And I went out there, you know, I wrote dozens of letters to women that I beat up and bullied. I went back to my mother's grave and made amends to her grave. I paid back and made restitution to, you know, places that I'd stole from and properties that I'd vandalized. And with every single piece of the puzzle, you know, that I cleaned up, it was like a piece of me was being restored, you know, and it was never instantaneous. I very rarely made an amends, and then all of a sudden I was like, man, I feel amazing. You know, it was never like that. Especially with my mother's grave. I didn't see that until way later. Because I made that amends. I had an old timer in California walk me through it. I wrote a letter and I read it to her grave and I cried and I meant what I said, but I felt nothing after that. And it was only until Mother's Day the next year, you know, that I cried, and it was the first time that I cried that I wasn't feeling sorry for myself. I felt genuine love, you know, genuine pure love for my mom. And I could say the word mom and not feel dirty on the inside. And after that experience, I started sponsoring these women and being able to be intimate and be close to them. You know, my whole life I've bullied and you know, put up this persona that I was this tough girl, that no one could get close to me. You know, I just float around. You know, no one could ever get close to me. I get pieces of me here, pieces of me there, and no one knows all of me. And for after that experience, and especially making amends to the women that I had beat up and bullied, you know, in my childhood, in my adolescence, and early adulthood, then I began to form true partnerships, you know, and I mean, it changed me. Because then, you know, when in living in 10 and 11 and 12, and in trying to live this way of life and trying to pass this on, You know, I was able to forge these relationships, and the women that I sponsor, I mean, have saved me. Because, you know, my sponsor, and it is a hard lesson to learn, you know, my sponsor is not my babysitter, is not my God, and can't fix me. You know, I'm still alcoholic. There is still no human power. You know, but with working with women and trying to carry this message, what ends up happening is that I end up going through the steps again. You know, I end up being held accountable. That when I want to take a night off, or when I don't want to reach out my hands to a newcomer, when I don't want to go to that conference, I have women that I sponsor that are asking me if I'm going to be there, and I have to. You know, I start going through these steps again, going through the book again. And, you know, in the last 2 years, I was talking to Sarah about it. I got this woman, Valerie D., from Richmond to sponsor me. And my sobriety was yet again revolutionized, you know. And when I was 5 years sober, I thought that I had figured everything out. You know, I had the right amount of sponsees, the right amount of service positions. You know, I had made amends to my father, which was, you know, a tremendous obstacle that, you know, after 4 years, I was able to make amends to him, and there was peace there. My family was being restored back to sanity, and things were fitting into place. I had a relationship. I had a job. I was pursuing my dreams, and, you know, it was like building my empire, and once again, it became all about Joyce, and the meeting became all about Joyce, and service in the home group became all about Joyce, and I was 5 years sober, and I felt like I want to kill myself again. And it was funny because my group takes a trip to Costa Rica, out of all places, like paradise. We took a trip out there. I'm like in a house full of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm like having panic attacks because I'm so uncomfortable with myself. And I had to come to another surrender, you know, because I didn't have a God. I had made all these things my God, and I had to come to another surrender. And I ended up getting this woman, you know, Valerie to sponsor me, and I went through the book again. And, you know, when I went through the book again, when it said to do something, I did it. When it said to pray, I prayed. When it said to, write, I wrote. And I tried to qualify again and recommit to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love that you guys do set-aside prayer. It's like my favorite thing, you know, because someone like me, I always think I know. You know, and I don't want to know. I want to be emptied of myself so I can have a new experience every single day. You know, so God can use me as a vessel every single day. Because my plans and ideas and agendas have never gotten me anywhere good, even in sobriety. You know, I still to this day don't know what's good for me. And AA, you know, like has everything good in my life. Every single area of my life is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. From my career, to my family, to where I live. I mean, it's all tied into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've forgotten that. You know, I've chased money, property, prestige, sex, and you know, try to satisfy my instincts at the expense of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've gone way off the beam. You know, I've been dishonest in relationships. I've stolen from my employers, dead sober. You know, and I'm grateful that this is not about perfection. You know, and that that if I'm willing to humble myself and admit where I'm wrong and ask God to take me to higher ground, you know, that people have always like, welcomed me back, and I've always been able to learn and grow from these experiences. And, you know, and just to talk more about my family, I mean, you know, second to obviously being sober and being given the reprieve of that mental obsession that owned me since I was 10 years old, I mean, second to that, the second greatest miracle of my life is my relationship with my father. You know, this is a man that I know I would have killed with my bare hands, that any judge, any therapist would have said that this is irreconcilable, this is toxic. And Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, shocked me at what it could do. It, I started writing letters to my dad every 2 weeks because we had to, you know, sever communications. And then I started visiting once a month with members of my group would babysit me and take me up there for just an afternoon and then take me back down to D.C. And then I started spending weekends by myself. And after 4 years, I was able to sit next to him on this stoop in Jersey City and make a direct amends, you know, and forgive him for what he had done, and he forgave me for what I had done. And we were able to build this new relationship. And, you know, I'm I don't have some sort of Brady Bunch family. You know, my father is not really a father. He's a friend. But I am able to be a part of his life. I'm able to, he trusts me with his children. You know, when he turned 60 this past year and he had a big party and he asked me to give this speech about him. You know, And he said that he didn't want anybody else to talk about who he was other than his daughter. And I could stand in front of all his family and friends and talk about the man that I once hated and talk about how I loved him today and how I meant that. And that is, I mean, that is definitely not my doing. You know, I mean, that is a product of Alcoholics Anonymous and the actions you all taught me. And I fall short, you know, just today. I mean, just this week, on the way up here, I was talking to my sponsor about, you know, being riddled with insecurity in relationships, being in financial fear, you know, having a bad attitude about sponsoring women. Or, you know, I'm still lazy, I'm still defective, I'm still selfish and self-centered. But every day, you know, I just try to live a little bit better than I did yesterday. And I try to stay teachable. And I'm so grateful for opportunities like this to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous and to tell my story, because I need to remember, you know, I'm not a nice girl that drank too much. You know, and I hope every day that I could live on this path with you all. So thanks for letting me share.